Okay, let's call the Senate Judiciary Committee together in order. We're at 1:37. I apologize for the delay coming in out of the joint session and a regular session. We have Senator Dyson with us, Senator McGuire, Senator Wilikowski, and Chairman Coghill. Last, when we had a meeting, an amendment came our way. It's amendment number one, and it deals with the auto waivers. Senator Dyson had introduced the amendment. We just ran the clock out is what happened, and I had every intention to bring it to a vote. Some people may think providentially that it was held over, and I think probably so. For me, I wanted to make sure that we got on record why this was an idea that could be put in this bill. I'm still not convinced of that, but I think we need to have the discussion here. And so, Senator Dyson, we kind of ended abruptly and didn't give you a chance to make any other comments. We have the Department of Law that yet want to speak. I have at least one public testimony, and I gave the people who had been kind of circulating the amendment the ability to have kind of the last say. But I wanted you to give kind of my introductory part to it, since you could at least review where we're at and what the amendment is for, so for those listening in, they don't have to get in halfway through a conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what happens under our criminal law, certain crimes perpetrated by juveniles that are somewhat heinous are automatically waived to adult court. And this happens before the trial, and 24 other states have gone through a process that in unusual circumstances there can be a judicial review, and the judge can make a decision on whether or not there are extenuating circumstances and whether or not this juvenile is a good candidate for rehabilitation. And so this is what the amendment we have put forward. That since we met last, we have had an amendment to the amendment drafted that would take the unclassified felonies out of the group that could be subject to judicial review. So that takes all the murder one and murder two out of it. And so we'll have that hopefully here in a few minutes before we vote on this bill. But that's coming, and we are committed to doing that. I think I'll save the rest of my remarks until we get to the end of this process.
I just wanted people to know this is in Senate Bill 64, which we have been working on truthfully since last May, and Senator Dyson has been a significant part of that. And as the chairman, I'm just reluctant to bring this issue into this bill. But if it gets in, because I knew there was some support on the committee, that I wanted a full vetting of why it should go in. We have the Department of Law here who was about ready to speak on it, but I could not run the committee over 3 o'clock last time because of other commitments. And then, in fairness to most people who are making amendments, I would like to have those who want to make the case for the issue to have the last say. But somebody who was personally affected by it, and one of our colleagues that had worked with us in the legislature, wanted to give personal testimony, and I wanted to give that opportunity. So that will kind of push our timeline out. And so what I would suggest is that we bring the amendment up for debates after all that, have amendments to the amendment, vote yes or no on the amendment, and then proceed. The rest of the stuff is going to be very light duty in comparison, because most of it's cleanup language that we agreed upon pretty much previous. So this is kind of the big issue. So Annie, with the Department of Law, would you be willing to come up at this point and talk to us about this particular amendment? Why don't you come on up and put yourself on the record? And then what I'll do is I have Ralph Samuels here, who also wanted to testify. Online, I've got Tony Piper and Brandon Berg. Tony Piper is Department of Health and Social Services. Brandon Berg is part of Department of Corrections, and both available for questions for those, if there's any technical issues we get into that want to be brought up. So, Annie, thank you for coming to the meeting, and appreciate any thoughts you have for us on this particular amendment, which is amendment number one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. And I want to thank everybody for their letting us work with you on SB 64. The spirit of cooperation has been really wonderful, and I think we've gotten to the place where in its current form it's in really good shape. But unfortunately, the administration is unable to support the amendment that would essentially eliminate the automatic waiver for minors who commit really serious crimes when they're 16 or 17 years old. There are two significant interests relevant here. First is, of course, an interest in doing the society's best to rehabilitate a minor. Nobody wants to throw a child away or a minor away. But there's another interest, too, and that's public safety. The problem is that some minors commit terrible crimes. We don't know why they do it. Sometimes we can guess as to maybe had a horrible childhood or something, but they do commit horrible crimes. And the problem is the juvenile justice system doesn't have very long to deal with 16 and 17-year-olds who do this. They have 16 or 17, they have till they're 19 years old, sometimes till they're 20 if the juvenile agrees to extend juvenile jurisdiction to their 20th birthday. But otherwise, it could be 3 years at most that the juvenile system has to work with people. As I said before, sometimes we can guess why a minor would commit a crime like this, sometimes not. But the fact is that although all humans do have bumps and as we grow up and mature from as teenagers, the vast majority of us don't commit murders and rapes. The juvenile system has a short time to deal with people like this, and that is probably not enough to rehabilitate a person who has committed some, and you will probably hear about them from other witnesses. I'm not going to describe them unless you want me to, but there have just been some really terrible crimes committed by young people in our state, and the auto waiver statutes were designed to address them. They're not perfect, and there's probably room for improvement. But to repeal them at this point, in this form, is probably not a good idea. The issues are really complex. The stakes are high. Drafting is very hard in this area because we've got long statutes, and there are so many different factors that have to be considered, people who have to be listened to. And I just get the feeling that we need a whole lot more information at this point. And this amendment, at least in the current form, is kind of a good example. According to what I've heard from the Division of Juvenile Justice, there are questions that need to be answered. For example, who does the risk assessments that are described in the amendment? According to the Division of Juvenile Justice, they don't have the authority to do those assessments with people who have been waived to the adult system. There are also questions of where minors go while they're being assessed. Where do these take place? And, of course, what happens to minors while the issue of waivers being litigated. And as we know, the issue of whether or not a waiver will be upheld has taken years, and till the minor is 21 at least. So there are a lot of questions that aren't addressed in the amendment that should be thought about. And as I say, I don't mean to be critical, but this is a tough area. And we noticed a concern in the drafting of it in that the way we read it, right now under the draft, it would be easier to waive to adult court a person under 16 who has been charged with murder than it would be to waive a person who is 16 or 17 charged with murder. And that is because it's an evidentiary issue. And for minors that are under 16 who have committed unclassified felonies or A felonies against a person, there's a rebuttable presumption that they are not amenable to treatment in the juvenile system. And that rebuttable presumption was not brought up, as far as we can tell, to the amendment that would address 16 or 17-year-olds that are charged with unclassified felonies or Class A felonies against a person.
So just on that, Annie, the idea was a preponderance of the evidence that their ability to be rehabilitated. And so that's one standard, and then the other standard, help me understand the brackets.
Well, under the amendment, as under current law, under current law, the state has the burden to prove that a child is unamenable to treatment. However, if a child under 16 years of age is charged with an unclassified or a Class A felony, there's a rebuttable presumption, in fact, that that child is not amenable, okay. which they started in a different place.
All right, that's what I needed to know.
And that rebuttable presumption that the child is not amenable to treatment is not addressed in this amendment to SB 64.
Okay.
Senator Dyson. On the point, but it also doesn't do away with that, correct?
It doesn't address it at all, which means that...
It means it stays in the present form.
For under 16-year-olds, not for 16 and 17-year-olds. And that would make it harder for the state, harder to prove that the person is unamenable. It's an evidentiary consideration that should be addressed. And it's just an example of one of the many things that need to be thought about when you change a procedure like this.
And Annie, just I'm going to make notice that Senator Olson has joined us some time ago, and so thank you, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I also have the feeling that there's a lot of information that I don't know that has even been asked for, let alone provided, in this area, because it's a complicated procedure and it's a complicated area of the law. We heard earlier that minors that are in custody who have been waived, live forlorn, lonely lives in often in segregated, they're not allowed to be, they're not placed with adults, adult offenders. But I didn't even know till yesterday that the Department of Corrections has a youthful offender facility in Anchorage where they put people who are young and they are indeed segregated from adult offenders, but they are not segregated from each other, so that they do have some social interaction and their lives are not necessarily in a single cell separated from other people. I think that the director of facilities from the Department of Corrections is online and available to answer questions. Another thing I would like to raise is that Title 27 already has a procedure called dual sentencing in law that in some cases allows the court to impose both a juvenile sentence and an adult sentence on a person so that the person can be addressed in the juvenile situation and then, depending on how he or she does, adult portion of the sentence may or may not be imposed. I'm told that it, in the current way it's drafted, it's not very useful. I have heard from that people don't use the dual sentencing, but it is a good idea for people in this situation where there is hope that they might be rehabilitated by 19 or 20 to give them a chance to do that and maybe impose an adult sentence if that's just not. It didn't happen by the time that the child got to be 20 years old. So there are things that we can do to work on the statutes to make them more responsive to the concerns that the sponsor of the amendment has and that other people have too. Eliminating dual sentencing the auto waiver is not one at this point that would be a good idea. There's just too many public safety concerns with it.
So. I do have a question, Annie, that maybe you can help me in, based on what Senator Dyson started with, and that is the unclassified are some of the more horrendous ones. Help me understand what would normally be charged under a Class A that this bill, this amendment would deal with unclassified and Class A's, and I think it leaves B's out, right?
Well, no. Under the current amendment, it just gives the possibility of this waiver decision on all cases that are auto-waived, and those include all unclassified felonies, that's murder, certain cases of sex trafficking, manslaughter, murder in the second degree. No, not manslaughter, I'm sorry. Murdered first and second degree, sexual assault, rape basically, and sexual abuse of a minor in the first degree. A Class A felony against a person would be attempted rape, attempted sexual abuse of a minor, robbery in the first degree. Those are examples of Class A felonies against
manslaughter.
Manslaughter, yes.
Right.
Yes. Current auto waiver addresses also arson, which is a Class A felony against but it's considered not a crime against a person, it's a crime against property, but it's a Class A felony. It includes arson, and it also includes one B felony, and that would be a B felony against a person where the person used a deadly weapon, and it was his or her second offense. He or she had already been adjudicated delinquent for a similar offense. And then two weapons offenses, the most serious weapons offenses.
That gives me some brackets on it, so thank you. Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And Annie, you may have touched on this through the chair. You may have touched on this before, but for the cases that Senator Dyson, some of them that he's referred to with manslaughter, you think about a young person perhaps that consumed alcohol as a minor or was texting and ran over somebody. Mm-hmm. Terrible, horrific crime, horrific. Life is gone forever. Mm-hmm. At the same time, perhaps society says you didn't have the same mental intent as an intentional murder. Mm-hmm. For those cases, I'm curious, and maybe you could give us some other examples, how is Title 27 working? And are there cases where this has really been an outcry? I mean, we know of the cases, and some of them we'll hear about today, where you truly have a young person, for whatever the circumstances are, that is behaving in a completely intentionally horrific way. Mm-hmm. But I haven't heard a lot of cases so far that have risen to the top for me as a lawmaker to think that auto waiver is somehow incarcerating young people for crimes that are, I would say, on the manslaughter side or the robbery or some of these others where there might be a potential. Mm-hmm. If there's a drug and alcohol intervention or something else, mm-hmm. for rehabilitation, being auto-waived into adult prison for life. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'd just like to hear some feedback on that. Is Title 27 working with dual sentencing? Is there something that's happening that we're not addressing?
Well, through the chair, Senator, auto-waiver dual sentencing could be that's why I'm saying dual sentencing might be an answer to questions to cases like you describe. I don't think we do have discretion in auto waiver cases to and sometimes it happens, although it doesn't happen very frequently, where a minor will be charged as an adult and auto waived or waived into the adult system, and then there is a plea agreement that we get new evidence or evidence maybe that would make it difficult to prove the waivable offense, and those can be negotiated and brought back to juvenile court. It doesn't happen very often, but I'm told that it does happen.
And then if I might just follow up through the chair, Ms. Carpinetti, though there is then in the sentencing, however, the opportunity for discretion somewhat. We do have mandatory minimum sentences, but there's somewhat discretion there for the judge to say this is an act of manslaughter versus an intentional homicide. Mm-hmm. And that would be then where that discretion would come in, and that individual would then be incarcerated at a juvenile facility, if you will.
Through the chair, if a person is charged, for example, your example with murder, and he or she is convicted of a non-waivable offense, they have the ability to, in the statute, there's a procedure where they can ask the court to get them back, you know, they can be moved back into the juvenile arena.
Okay.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. I understand that the Attorney General in the last year has said no more plea bargaining on some classes of felonies. What's the, straighten me out on that.
Through the chair, it's the policy is no sentence bargaining for yeah. serious offenses, but they would include these, but that doesn't apply to, for example, reducing a charge if the evidence shows that we can't. That, you know, sometimes a person will be indicted by a grand jury and a late report will come in from the police that will show us that we, in fact, do not have the evidence to prove what was originally charged, and the charges can be reduced or changed.
Just to clarify.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I understood most bargain deals, it was the plea bargain, they agree to a charge, and part of it is a sentencing pre-agreement. And you're, So you're saying that now there'll be no sentencing bargains for felonies?
Through the chair, not all felonies, just certain felonies. And I'll be happy to get you the written policy, because there is one, but it doesn't apply to all felonies.
Okay.
Certain
all right.
felonies.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Wilkowski also has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There, Senator Dyson was suggesting that if we took out unclassified felonies, there may be an amendment to do that. Does that change your opinion at all on this bill?
Through the chair, that would certainly be better if only unclassified felonies were auto-waived. It would be better. I still believe that it would be preferable to look at the whole picture and get information about how many people are waived but of course it would be better to limit it to the change to A's and B's than the whole group
in
offenses.
And right now, I mean, it's only, and I'm just trying to figure this out a little better in my mind. So right now, the only times that a 16 or 17 Actually, no, I guess the 16 or 17-year-old would be auto-waived are for those times you mentioned, the unclassified felonies, the Class A felonies, arson, and a Class B felony that is a crime against a person in which a minor is alleged to use a deadly weapon. Those are the only times.
And it's the second one. It's a second deadly weapon offense. That's the only B that this.
So right now, kids who go in and break windows or do things like that, maybe convicted of a felony, is there, under this law, the way it's currently written, is there the chance that they're going to get auto-waived into the adult system?
None. No. They will be treated as juveniles. They would not be auto-waived. I mean, there is a discretionary waiver statute, but I would be surprised if it would ever be applied to a property crime.
Okay. And did you give a list of Class A felonies? Could you go just real quick, give me?
I could go through the statutes and give you all of them. It shouldn't take too long. Because these are only crimes against a person.
Class A's are all crimes against a person?
No, the bill deals with Class A's that are crimes against a person.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dyson.
My chief of staff has it in his handy book right there.
It's an A felony, I mean, manslaughter, assault in the first degree, manslaughter of an unborn child, certain kidnapping crimes, not all of them. Sexual assault in the first degree is an unclassified felony. Rape, but attempted rape is a Class A felony. An attempted sexual abuse of a minor is a Class A felony. And then robbery in the first degree. And that's about it.
Thank you.
And Mr. Kopp, does that agree with the list that you had there? I'm just out of curiosity. I mean, she's flipping through the statutes pretty quickly. If you want to come and just round that out.
Actually, the second offense of online enticement of a minor is a Class A felony.
Okay. Thank you.
But that wouldn't. And I know, that wouldn't be this because it's online enticement of a minor.
I was trying to help you out because I know you're flipping through the statutes as much as you can.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Put yourself on the record.
Yes, for the record, Mr. Chairman, Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Fred Dyson. Ms. Carpentier is correct. In addition to what she mentioned, we also have criminal mischief first degree, which is if you damage an oil or gas pipeline facility or you damage property of a utility. And there, it creates an emergency that involves danger to life or property. That's also
so. But those would be crimes against property crimes, not crimes against a person,
they,
right?
They can be. It's a Class A felony. Now, does the Class A felony there only apply to
crimes against a person?
Okay,
so property crimes like criminal mischief would not.
A felony or arson? Did you mention that?
Yeah, I did mention arson.
Felony. Yeah. Okay, so we got pretty much the list, and you guys are.
This is the new
good team there.
I should have brought it. Chuck gave you a copy.
But I just would, because I saw you flipping through the statutes, and I know that if he had the list.
Yeah.
But it clarifies the fact that we're talking about against a person.
Yes.
Talking about crimes against a person. So that's very helpful.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wolf.
If I could, I appreciate Senator Dyson's I agree in concept with him about trying to figure out ways that we can rehabilitate kids. And I'm concerned just where do you draw that line when kids who are very mature convicting just these heinous crimes. And I understand, and I'm just learning in the last few days about the long history of this bill and how there were a couple of years ago, I guess, a multi-year process. Can you talk a little bit about that and what just briefly about the process that
I think you have somebody in the audience who is would be better at that, because
I
was not
that.
In this job in 1994, and I wouldn't give you the
probably a good segue into the time, because I think you've answered some of the questions to date, and that, this is one of my objections to putting it in this bill, because it begins every time you turn a word over, it unfolds a whole new set of circumstances, and so with that, I still think the debate is good, and I think having it on record should it get into this bill is very important as to that we took it very deliberately. So if you don't mind, I'd go ahead and have Ralph Samuels, who has been in the past a colleague of ours and who has been in this both personally and professionally, and I greatly appreciate the fact that he's in town. It was, I think it's beneficial to us as far as the substance of the debate and also how it actually impacts real lives, and so I appreciate that. Why don't you put yourself on record, give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. my name is Ralph Samuels, and I'm here speaking on my own behalf. And I'm going to start off
brief at ease.
Yeah, we can just take it at ease and let you catch your...
I'm going to start off and tell you a very sad story about my family, and then to Senator Wilikowski's point, I'll walk you through the bill and the process. So,
and we know that you're going to bring personal life into this, and we greatly appreciate it. So.
I'm trying to hurry up. I really
right.
I get it. Okay.
We just got to deal with the issue.
No, I understand.
Your testimony is a big part.
In my instance, I'll skip my notes. What happened to my family is that my brother was murdered, in his own home, in a robbery gone horribly wrong, by a 16-year-old Jervis High School student, and this was not a drug deal gone bad. This was a true victim crime, and you know. We found his body on October the 5th and October the 6th of 1989. APD arrested guy, and the waiver proceeding under the law at the time took 6 years. 6 years to determine whether or not a man who had confessed to the crime on videotape, an execution-style murder, was a juvenile or not. That's the process that, not in totality, but essentially, that's what the Amendment Number 1 goes back to. Not completely, Senator Dice. I understand philosophically where you're trying to come to, fair. But about halfway through this process in 1993, Senate Bill 54, there were a series of murders, earlier from a woman behind me, and in the same time frame, there were a series of murders and violent offenses by young juveniles. So at the time, former Senator Halford introduced a bill, Senate Bill 54, and over a two-year stretch, they had public testimony, the ACLU didn't like it, and the OPA didn't like it, and the DA did like it, and the public defenders didn't like it. They had victims' rights groups. They had, quite frankly, large rallies in Anchorage over this very issue. That is really only a handful of people that get affected by it. This is not a policy that hopefully affects very many people. So the bill, as it moved forward in the legislature, it defined, as Annie testified to, it defined a very narrow scope of offenders. This isn't a guy selling a bag of weed on the schoolyard or stealing a car and joyriding or some vandalism or anything. This is where somebody got hurt badly. A woman got raped. You know, my brother got killed. There were other murders that are involved with this thing. So in this two-year process, the legislature, in a very broad show of support, very bipartisan, I believe in the House it lost 5 votes. I don't remember exactly what the Senate vote was. The debate included all of the issues that this amendment is new to me, you know, as of yesterday. So it was the probability of reformation. It was brain development on teens, the same issues that you guys are grappling with right now. Community protection that Annie just talked about. All of these points were debated, and not to say that they shouldn't be again. I'm not saying that at all. McLaughlin Youth Center, or whatever division of the Division of Juvenile Justice that they're in, they came forward and they said their problem had become that you get these violent offenders that had gone into the system, like Mr. Norton, the man who killed Dwayne. He would be in the system, and he was in there for so long that he became a role model for the guy selling that was selling weed or shoplifting or something in there, and he became the hero model in there, and they had to get rid of him. They wanted to. They ended up reluctantly, but it was, they came forward in favor of the bill because they had to get rid of this handful of kids that were sending the wrong message. So, and I know that I spoke at length with Mr. Kopp yesterday, and I know OPA's going to come up here after I do. If you open the door to a waiver proceeding, whether it be just for the Class A's, for the amendment to the amendment, and you take away the unclassifieds, if you open the door a little bit, it's not going to be just the kid in the back of the car that didn't know his friends were going to rob the liquor store. You know, sorry to steal your example there, Chuck, but it's not going to be that guy that they try to waive. Their job, OPA's job, and the PD's job, is to zealously defend the client. And if they have an opportunity, even the kid with the gun, if they're going to try it. They may fail. And I've been told that nobody's ever been not waived to adult court that actually was the shooter, but I'm here to tell you, they tried. I have letters, and if this amendment goes in, I will bring them forward to the next committee where Dwayne was murdered in his own home, and I have a letter from the public defender in OPA that said, well, there are elements of self-defense in there. Well, I don't know, he was executed. So, sorry, Mr. Public Defender. It didn't fly, it didn't work, but have no illusions that that's not exactly their job. If they didn't do it, I suppose they wouldn't be doing their job, would be to zealously defend their client, and that is what they're going to try to do. It's their role in the system. Intellectually, I get it. Emotionally, I've got problems with it. But if you open the door a little bit, Senator, they're all going to try to walk through. And I'd like to end. I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm better now. And I want to comment a little bit on the same year in 93 and 94, the legislature voted, and probably, you know, I think there were two no votes in the Senate, but probably unanimous in the House. They put a Victims' Rights Amendment to the Constitution of the State of Alaska. So Article 1, Section 12, and Article 1, Section 24 deal with the rights of crime victims. And if I may read
yes.
Article 1, Section 12, criminal administration shall be based upon the following: the need for protecting the public, community condemnation of the offender, the rights of victims of crimes, restitution from the offender, and the principle of reformation. And the debate on that resolution, that particular piece of legislation, the debate on there wasn't whether it's just to include those five, was to number them in order. And the order that I read them, they chose at the end, the legislature chose to put these on there, and those five pillars of criminal administration are in the Constitution. So the principle of reformation and the rights of the victims of crime are equal. At one point, it was going to be reformation was last of the five. And the numbers got taken out during the debate on the issue. And I guess if I had put in my political hat on, if I had political advice for the committee and for the legislature as a whole, if you follow the principles in Article 1, Section 12, and you want to have a debate on this issue, put a bill in, because I can guarantee I happen to be in Juneau today to go to the Children's Trust fundraiser tonight. you know. He happens to be in Juneau. It's a fluke. I had a phone call that told me about the amendment. I haven't heard any other victims' rights groups, and I'm just an individual guy, but I can guarantee that the CDVSA would have an opinion about this. Victims for Justice would have an opinion about this. The Office of Victims' Rights, which work for you guys, would have an opinion about this. STAR would have an opinion about this. You know, does a woman who's raped care if he's 17 or he's reached his 18th birthday? My guess is no, but they should certainly have an input. And if you've got a couple months left in a session to go to, these groups have to get to the boards of directors to take a position to do all of these things. So if you look at the Constitution that the criminal administration should be following, now I'm not saying that the bill is going to be unconstitutional if you don't do that, I'm not go that far, but the rules that you all should be following here, you should be getting input from more than a, as my father would call it, a rather dispassionate argument between the public defender's office and the DA arguing where to draw that line. And I understand what the nuance is. I intellectually understand these things, but I think that you have to say we're supposed to include the voice of the victims of these crimes, including all of these groups, quite frankly, that I just named, and probably others that I don't know about. They should have a voice. They should be the ones sitting here instead of some poor schmuck who happened to end up in the wrong place at the wrong time here, and I'm the spokesman now. So it is a bigger topic, and my view is if the amendment gets put, I have no idea what the underlying bill does, Mr. Chairman. Chuck explained it to me a little bit, but I really don't know. I haven't followed it. But if this amendment gets put on there, the bill is not going to pass, even with the amended amendment. This is a lightning rod issue, whether you think it is or not. There are going to be people that are going to fall on their swords,
right,
including myself. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. Greatly appreciate you taking the time. And I know it was actually fortunate for the committee to get your testimony, in my view, because sometimes what happens here, you're right, we have both the philosophical, intellectual, and statutorial debate. And the people on both sides of the issue, whether it's for reformation, accountability, or the victims, always have to be kept in mind. And I kind of started that conversation on this amendment saying I always, in my mind, whenever I'm doing anything, even with some of the things we're doing in the underlying bill, to keep the victim central to the question of whether it's restoration for them or restoration for the offender. And so I greatly appreciate it, Ralph, very, very much. Yes, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and through the chair, and I don't think it was unfortunate at all that you were in town. I thank you very much for coming forward, and it's always hard when we have personal life experiences to put them on the record, but it's what motivated you to serve our state, and I thank you for that and the sacrifice to your family, and I really greatly appreciate the bravery of putting it on the record. It shows you also that we can forget, legislative institutions forget, and there's a tendency to feel like we're the first people reflecting on something. And I appreciate Senator Wilikowski's question that led to the history of that, to put that on the record as well. I just want to make two points as well. First is today we heard from Chief Justice Dana Fabe, and I thought it was so remarkable and wonderful to hear her refer to the legislation that passed out of this committee and this body recently that put a time limit on the requirement to expedite rulings that favor victims, that allow victims to have that closure, and that they ought to be included and to be noticed when there are chances for the offender to come up for parole and other things. And the second point I want to make is when Ralph and I served together on judiciary and the other body, myself, Ralph, and Representative Stoltz every year made this commitment, and I think we ought to renew it, which is that we would pass one piece of victims' rights legislation alongside all the other things that are going on to really put that constitutional requirement into practice and action, because it is absolutely the case that you have Alaskans that are human beings whose lives are forever affected that ought to be considered at the same time. Yeah. So it's something for us to think of, Mr. Chairman, as we move forward.
Yeah. Thank you. We I gave the opportunity for the person who had been proposing and actually helping us get this amendment on the table. I wanted him to be able to have the last say. He had was previously testified, so why don't you come on up, put yourself on the record, and we'll have your input, and then we'll debate the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chris Provost. I did work for the Office of Public Advocacy for 22 years. I retired in June, so I'm not here representing the Office of Public Advocacy. I would first like to acknowledge Mr. Samuels and thank you for telling the story. I can't tell you how many times a defendant has sat here and the victims and their advocates come to the podium and tell their story to the court, and I can't help but tear up as well. 6 years for that process to take place is outrageous. It's an aberration I've never heard of.
You have to speak into the mic because you got to record it. Sorry.
I've been doing auto wave kids and discretionary wave kids and the run-of-the-mill juvenile delinquents for many years. And it would be malpractice. It's not just zealous advocacy, but it would be malpractice for that proceeding to take that long because there won't be any time and the judge will waive. 4 to 6 months at most, especially if the child is or the juvenile is 16 years old. The courts are very diligent about that. They understand the timetables involved. I would also say the court system in the last few years has been extremely diligent about hearing from victims and victims' advocates, especially in these serious proceedings. And I guarantee you our judges take their comments and their stories into consideration when they make a decision. That's a reform that has taken place in the court system since Mr. Samuels' loss. If I may, I'd like to go through some of the points that were raised because we have...
I would like for you to do it briefly, only because I would like to have some discussion here. So
sure.
I would ask you to keep it as concise as you can because you've already had one chance to testify.
Right. This is not a repeal. It's not an elimination of auto waiver. It's a provision for judicial review. As far as some of the concerns raised, where do minors stay during the process? They stay in the adult prison until a determination is made. I know that's a concern of the Juvenile Justice Department. I don't understand the reasoning how it's easier to waive 16 and 15 and younger. That rebuttable presumption, it is absolutely our intention that that rebuttable presumption that the juvenile is not amenable to treatment should be part of this. It may not be there in language because when you are auto-waived, you are also, at the start of the proceeding, you are like any adult defendant. Do we use the language, there's a rebuttable presumption that you're guilty or that you can be rehabilitated? It doesn't really fit here, but the burden is still on the juvenile to prove that he's amenable to treatment by the age of 20. I don't understand the reasoning that the state has the burden to prove a juvenile is not amenable to treatment. Discretionary waiver is explicit about it. I believe this amendment is explicit, and if you want to incorporate a rebuttable presumption clause, that's not a problem. The only time, and I can say in 24 years, I don't think I've ever seen it used, the only time the state would have a burden to prove the juvenile is not amenable to treatment is also under 4712-100, and it's that first paragraph. If a juvenile it could be any offense, it could be a Class C felony, and if the department, through their attorneys, argue at a juvenile hearing, this kid's just not amenable. He's been in our system. He's been in and out on probation. He does another burglary. He's just not amenable. The statute says, well, then the court hears this and agrees, the juvenile petition is dismissed, and then the state has the choice to bring on the adult case. Again, they would have the same burden that they would have for any defendant, and the same rights would attach to the defendant. Segregation, yes, corrections has done a great job in trying to deal with that problem. The youthful offender program was in Seward, it's now in Anchorage. But I can tell you this as well, because before I left OPA, I had a 16-year-old, and he was allowed to go to the school programming in the juvenile defender unit. But once school was out, or if they were taking a break, he was put in a cell, and he could only look through the window. So maybe that's something that can be tweaked, and then he'd go back to segregation for the rest of his time. Senator Dyson, through the chair, the exchange about no plea bargains, I'm curious about the written policy as well, because, and I don't know if there's anybody online that was intending to testify, but my understanding that the policy applies to plea bargains as well, and for most cases involving violence against other people. It's not just a, we won't agree to a sentencing agreement. That's our experience. So, and through the chair, Senator Lukowski, your question about can juveniles be waived for property crimes if they're felonies, for example, they can through this provision. It's just never used, and I don't understand why. The problem with dual sentencing and incorporating this sort of amendment or these type of offenses under dual sentencing is that in order for the adult sentence to be imposed, the juvenile has to be determined not to be amenable to treatment. So there's a waiver hearing anyways as well. Before you get sentenced, you have an opportunity to prove to the court why sentence should not be imposed. So you're going to have that hearing whether you use dual sentencing or not, just like you have it in discretionary waiver. As far as taking out the unclassifieds, the practical reality is those kids who are the proactive aggressors and do the heinous crimes, they're going to get waived. We have a good bench. In opposing this amendment, it could be viewed that the Department of Law is saying, trust us. You can't trust one of our judges to make this important decision. I'm not worried about the ones that we know are going to get waived, even if they get their day in court. I'm more concerned about what we see more often, which is the example that was used. Kids who have no idea that someone's carrying a weapon, they intend to do a robbery or a burglary, and then someone pulls out a gun and shoots and kills the homeowner. That kid, through accomplice liability, is going to be charged with first-degree murder. That's how it works. The same charge is whether you were the shooter or whether you even there was any discussion about hurting anybody. And I see that more often with kids because there's often a younger juvenile with young adults along for the ride. It's usually the young adult, who is committing the heinous crime. So I'm a little concerned about, there's not going to be that many of them. There may not be any during any particular year, but some of those kids slipping into the adult system when they're not nearly as culpable as the adults themselves or co-defendants. I think with that, I have more points, but I'd rather give...
I was going to ask you to wind down, but I do want to give time for a couple of questions if there's a couple of questions. I really appreciate you taking the time, and I know I put you under probably more time pressure than others, but this is the second time you had a chance to Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. Well, Chris, first of all, as I think Mr. Samuels, I want to thank you for your heartfelt testimony as well, and I know that you come at it from your background and your belief that there should be more for kids in the system, and so I thank you for that. And my question for you, I'm inclined not to include this. amendment in this bill for a variety of reasons. I think that the subject is a separate bill. I think that Mr. Samuels makes a great point that it's being put in kind of a way that could be viewed as a slap in the face to those who are victims' rights advocates, because there just hasn't been that notice. There hasn't been that time. I think that the subject matter is so complex. And as pointed out, just the disagreement between yourself and our attorney and the Department of Law about whether or not the rebuttable presumption makes it easier or harder, right there, that's a couple of committee hearings that I can think of. And I would want more, as an attorney myself, I would want more testimony on that. So I'm not inclined to support this. That doesn't mean that I'm not inclined to listen to the fact that there may be places in the system where opportunities for those young people who truly make mistakes without intention can be rehabilitated in the state of Alaska, because I do believe in our young people, and I do believe that there are those moments. And so I would like to hear, just briefly, if there are any efforts besides this particular amendment at this point that you're undertaking to pursue with the Department of Corrections or any other things with respect to juvenile housing, juvenile, where they're housed in the system, their rehabilitation opportunities, those kinds of things.
As a assistant public advocate, I worked closely with the Department of Juvenile Justice, or the division, not just on the individual cases, but on those very issues, their rehabilitation program, and as well as corrections, not just with individual clients, but with the idea of in support of the youthful offender program. In fact, it was a compromise to a potential lawsuit that these kids were held in solitary till 18, and in response to that, they opened up their youthful offender program for the 16 and 17 year olds who would normally have had to have waited till they were 18 before they could move into that program. Does that answer your question? That we do try to work out other options besides just this option of having a judge review and make a decision.
Through the chair, it does, and I think you might find more support in the legislature and sharing some of those ideas and things that we can do. You know, we all are members of budget subcommittees. So, for example, in the Department of Corrections and Department of Law and those kinds of things, perhaps there are opportunities for us to invest more in places where you're talking about the actual detention of a young person. The idea of a person, you know, staring out of a solitary confinement, I mean, clearly we're a humane society. But at the same time, I mean, I think Mr. Samuels brings up the point that there are heinous crimes committed by people that happen to be young, and lives are lost forever. And there's nothing we can do legislatively to give that life back. And so I think we have to err on the side of the victims.
Senator Dyson, you had something as well?
Yes. Why doesn't the dual, can you rehearse again why the dual sentencing thing isn't used and doesn't work largely?
I don't think it's been used 10 times since the statute was passed. It's a convoluted statute. Two prosecutors could read it and interpret it differently how to do it procedurally. Two judges could read it and come up with two different takes on it as well. It would need a complete overhaul. But it will also provide, it's not a reverse waiver type of hearing, but it will involve a hearing before a judge to determine whether or not the sentence should be imposed.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. What I'd like to do is go ahead and have the committee discussion on this amendment at this point so that we can we have one other amendment, which is pretty much the cleanup. But Senator Dyson.
Brief at ease.
Sure. Let's take a brief at ease. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. I also would, I worked on a whole bunch of the restorative justice things, with Representative Ethan Berkowitz, and makes the first order in our law that restoration of the victim, do everything we can to restore and the funds. We've got a bill going through now that cleans that up and makes that happen better. And we also had the return of property thing that gets, you know, so we're doing our at least one victim's bill per year. I also would like you to think about, and this happened to me, 10 years old, laying in bed, hearing an escalating argument that was headed for violence involving my mother, and being terrorized as a child and think, what do I do? You know, what do I do to rescue my mother in this situation? And almost powerless. I mean, I knew where there was guns, but I had to go past the violent scene to get them and so on. Fortunately, our boxer dog intervened, you know. But I remember that terror and feeling of helplessness. So think about the kid who is listening to his mother or watching his mother get beat up one more time, you know, and can't do anything there, but gets a chance off scene to take the guy out. And he's watched this happen to his mother, you know, and so on and so forth. And there's the perp. Domestic violence restraining order isn't doing it, you know, and there he has a chance. And he's 16 years old and shoots the guy. You know, I think there's a guy, there's extenuating circumstance. Think about, and I know this one very personally through my foster kid. Kid's been abused over and over again sexually in horrible ways, often almost always with somebody they know, family member and stuff. And finally he's had it and they snap. And they maybe just want to disable the person, but they use too big a hammer, you know, or whatever, and they kill the guy. We're automatically going to waive those to a court. And because they did it not when the crime against them was happening, you know, there's not the argument of defense. Doesn't apply. So there's somebody that, out of other remedies, you know, did what they had to do. And as you brought up about the kid. So I think there's some valid reasons here. I appreciate the pushback. Anyways, I suspect this is not going to pass, and maybe it shouldn't. I don't want to hobble a very good piece of legislation that's going for. So we have some more discussion, and I have one final thing I'd like to say.
And for me, many of the things that you said, I've worked with you on and agree with you on. But when you have a crime such as that we're talking about here, they still get a hearing before a judge, they get defense, and they get to have their peers look over their shoulder. Many of the victims don't get that. And I think, in my view, I would rather see a system where a trial jury, where the facts are laid out and the peers get to be a part of it. You don't have the confidentiality, you don't have the timeout problems. I think restoration still, even under that circumstance, is still one of the focuses of our judicial system. So I see that bring it out, let it be what it is, let the victims have the right for the potential of justice, and let the youngster at this point who has done a huge crime get the peers and the judicial system, which still has the focus of restoration and restitution. You know, you and I have worked so many times together on restorative justice issues. You pull my heartstrings genuinely, and I'm actually looking at this. So then the other thing that I have is maybe this is a way of getting some flexibility in, and I'm actually open to the discussion. But then in listening to the discussion that we've had in here, compared to some of the discussion we've had previous to this bill, and we've met in last March, we met in May, we met in July, we met in, I can't remember when the other date was, hammering out how do we do this. So it may very well be that something like this could be included with the Sentencing Commission in what that might look like. But I have a feeling it's a debate that we have here. So the Title 27 issue, plea bargaining issues, the values of the crimes, the dual sentencing, the process issues, the classified versus unclassified. In my view, what we've done is we've put in this bill a discussion that was way out of the scope of where we were headed. So it's a turn that that I'm not willing to take on at this point. I'm definitely willing to take the issue on, because I think the larger discussion has to happen. So at this point, no matter how you amend the bill or amend the amendment, I'm not going to be supportive for those reasons, and I would encourage you to not proceed with it. But if you do, I'll bring it to a vote, and I have been snookered in my committee before. So any other comments on the I think you said that you had an amendment to the amendment. Do you want to propose that, or how do you want to move forward? You want me to take in at ease?
No.
Okay. All right. It's up. I got the floor there.
So. All right. So we've added other things on to the Sentencing Commission here, and I don't think it's out of line for this one to have been considered. But be that as it may, I have begged the Department of Law to take on these issues of sentencing review, the smart justice, disproportionate sentencing, and that whole business. And there's two attorney generals and the governor and several people, and they have not. And I said to Sabatini and I said to Garrity, you guys are the experts. You know, you all kind of tell me, yeah, you're in favor of this, and what we have now is not working. 60-some percent of the people in prison are not violent and no threat to public safety. 2.5, almost 3 times as many Native people. We have overcrowded prisons. We are incarcerating at the 4th or 5th highest rate in the nation. A report here from the Justice Forum saying that we are amongst the worst states in the nation in barriers to reentry. And there's some 500 things that you can't get a job and you can't do, and you know, and so on and so forth. And near as I can tell, the Department of Law has refused to pick up this issue and go forward. They default it to us, you know, and we're an awkward group to do it. The Department of Law is the one with the information, the one with the responsibility to deal with these things. We're going to be, at the present rate, building another $350 million prison in 6 years. Mm-hmm. And it does not appear to me that the Department of Law is being active in dealing with that problem. Now, I can't tell you what people's intentions are, and I don't know what's going on behind the scenes. But mass is a big deal for me. I see various things going on. I think, what can integrate all these various things going on? What describes it? And I believe that Ms. Carpinetti and the governor and Attorney General Garrity really kind of know the system needs to be changed and want it to happen. The inertia in the department seems to keep them from picking up the ball and taking it forward. We have not seen virtually, I can't remember, anything coming from Department of Law cleaning up, including this dual sentencing thing, you know, to make it work. So I'm just very disappointed. And so, anyways, and I don't mean to be personally insulting, I think it's on the edge of irresponsibility with all that we've got going here. By and large, corrections is really on board with it. The treatment people really on board with some smart justice, not this specific thing on the juvenile waivers, which is just a very small part. So I, Mr. Chairman, withdraw the amendment, and thank you for the consideration. And I won't be here to prosecute it, bring something like this forward. I hope somebody else does. And I hope desperately the Department of Law will put together a task force. There's a half a dozen around, the pieces of it on the whole criminal justice stuff. And they'll be the ones that'll bring us a very comprehensive package on dealing with all this. Thank you.
So we'll withdraw Amendment Number 1, first of all, gratefully, but secondly, with the recognition that you have brought a question that probably is going to be looking for answers. So with that, we'll withdraw Amendment Number 1, and I have an amendment that was brought to you that is going to be laid in front of your desk, and I'll take a brief of these so you can kind of shuffle your papers and get to it. With that, we have right before you an amendment labeled E3. It's to draft version E by Gardner. And I will move the amendment, amendment number 3. And why don't you object?
I'll object.
So that we can have it heard. And I'll have, this is amendment number 2. And I'll have Jordan go through and explain it. But I will give you kind of the top-end explanation. The Nygren credit, we were trying to find a proper language set. And I think between the Department of Law, Public Defender, and our legal team, we finally come up with the right language. The rest of it is pretty much the cleanup language that we talked about last session, last time we were in committee. So, Jordan, identify yourself.
Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. This is Amendment E3, and again, it's cleanup language that came out of the last meeting. So the first change is just to the title. The second change is to remove the word entice from Senator Wilikowski's amendment, and that was something that was brought to our attention by the public defender, and it's removing the word entice is also something that the Department of Law thought would be appropriate, simply because, you know, this section included the word entice, but it didn't clarify what the person was enticing them to do.
You've got to move a little faster than that.
The next change is what we're just clarifying here, we're making it crystal clear that by us changing the felony theft threshold, we're not somehow affecting prior offenses.
Got it.
Okay.
The next change is simply to say crimes involving domestic violence, not crimes of domestic violence, just a wording preference.
Got it.
The next change is to clarify, is to ensure that if someone is staying in a treatment facility and is getting credit for time served, if for whatever reason they have a day where they don't do something that's a rehabilitative purpose, that it doesn't jeopardize their time served for the whole program. So it's just to say what you do on that day is only affects that day. We remove the word plan and the director of. That's just to make sure that we're not restricting the Nygren credit too much. Again, the Department of Law and the Public Defender came to some agreement on that. Page 14, line 7, we remove and place it with or. Again, just a wording preference. Page 14, line 13, in order to tighten up the reporting a little bit, instead of saying by close of next business day, we say within 24 hours.
And that was to keep it closer to what we talked about, 24/7, rather than having it skip over a day.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. Page 14, line 17, we're just simply clarifying this subsection, not G of the section. Again, just a wording preference. Page 21, line 31, just a drafting error that we're ameliorating right now, and we're adding burglary and criminal trespass into the applicability statutes. The next page and a half is just renumbering. And then finally, we add a new section here where we simply say that the Department of Corrections can start adopting regulations or can start working on regulations right away for some of these items. They don't have to wait till the effective date to start adopting regulations. And that's it, Mr. Chairman.
Right.
So, objection.
I think that that was what we discussed pretty much in committee here. Is there any other objection to it? Senator Dyson? So with that, amendment number 2 will be adopted. Thank you, Jordan.
Should I make a motion, Mr. Chairman?
And that brings us to the bill. And after the last debate, it seems almost going to take the air out of the balloon. But I really thank the committee for the work that we've done here. Senator McGuire?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we move out of committee the CS for Senate Bill number 64 as amended today, the / E version as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Any objections or comment? You want me to?
Just, Mr. Chairman, thank you and Senator Ellis and others for doing it. The Sentencing Commission was in law, 18 years ago. There are very prominent in many other states. There's a national convention of them. People all over the nation are working on this stuff, and I'm really proud of you guys for doing it, and Senator Ellis for never giving up on it. there's another one that's still in the law about disproportionate sentencing and stuff on drug offenses, and the administration, for whatever reason, has never chosen to impanel that. It's just a shame. But anyways, I'm really proud of you guys for doing it, to the committee.
And just for my part, gratitude to this committee, to Senator French, to Senator Ellis, and then Senator Dyson. I know you and I have worked tirelessly across the hall since we work so close together, for your staff and my staff. Very grateful. I think we've hammered out probably a good way to move forward on both restorative justice, restitution, and public safety. So I think we got a good shot at it. Is there any other comments before we take is there any objection at this point? All right, so we'll move Senate Bill 64 is amended and with forthcoming fiscal notes. All right. Let's adjourn this committee. Let's go do something else.